meeting will come to order. I was just waiting for one more member. We had two people who came and ducked out to get some food before they started. They'll be rejoining us soon. But everyone gets gold stars who managed to get here this quickly. Members, Ms. Dyson put together a couple of reports for you that are in your files. One of them looks like this, and this is the history from 2000 to 2012, specifically of flood hazard mitigation grants. And she points out that that number, that you see a total number, $355 million, would be larger if we went back to the beginning of the Red River Basin flood prevention projects, which she believed was at the 1997 floods. I'm not altogether sure whether that's the right date. And then we also, because embedded in here, we have the history of flood relief bills. For both of the subjects that we're discussing today, there's a little bit of history in both of these reports, and I know they'll be sharing more of that with you. But that's maybe we'll pick them out of members' folders, and those who aren't here today will send them as well. But today we have Kent Lacasmo, Director of Division of Waters, here. And I don't know if you're joined by somebody else, but we're happy to have you with us. And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. And you have a handout that looks like this, right?
Correct, Madam Chair.
And then this one is yours as well. Members in your files have a color-coded copy. Those are the two I think you'll be referring to.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And for the record, I'm Kent Lacasmo. I'm the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. I was the Director of Division of Water, so I managed this program for 20-some years. But and also with me today, some of the technical, Pat Lynch, who administers the program, and Mary Presnell, our both staff for ecological and water resources.
So sorry for the misidentification.
Oh, that's quite all right. And I'll go through the PowerPoint and then get to the other colored spreadsheet at the end and explain what's in that. Flooding is the number one natural disaster in the United States. And this is a picture of the Red River of the North in 1997, which I think a lot of people have seen in the past. And we've had, in the country, there have been $8 billion in damages in 2011 alone. And this is a picture of Moorhead in 1897. So they've had big floods before. And that was actually 100 years prior to the big flood of 1997 that really got the flood hazard mitigation program going.
And what year did you say?
Excuse me?
You said, what was the year?
Oh, 1997 was the East Grand Forks disaster. And after that, the funding has significantly increased for the flood hazard mitigation program.
So 1997 would have been the year when things wrapped up a little bit.
Yes, and I have a chart in a little bit that shows that. And just as a matter of perspective, between 1957 and 2012, there have been 40 flood-related federal disaster declarations in Minnesota. And just a couple more pictures. This is the city of Rushford in 2007. And the thing to point out here is that the kind of the top of the picture, you'll see what looks like that's the dike, the levee that protected the community. And that was, and they had a Corps of Engineers certified levee, but there was a bigger storm, and it was overtopped, and basically every home in town was flooded. So flood mitigation is cost effective. The FEMA did a study that showed that they believe $4 is saved for every $1 invested in mitigation. And since 1987, we've acquired over 3,200 structures that have been bought and removed from the floodplain. And that's been our highest priority effort, because then you don't have to worry about any maintenance and keeping some system working to protect the communities. And there's thousands more structures that are protected by the other structural type works, the levees, diversions, flood walls, pumping stations. And the it's pretty hard to read this. I know the in the city of Austin, they spent of federal, state, and local money, you know, $13 million to remove homes and businesses from the floodplain. And in 2010, the director of public works there has estimated that that saved $7.3 million in flood damages. In the city of Oslo, which I have a slide later, that ends up kind of being an island during these big Red River floods, but that cost about $3 million to build in the 60s, I believe it was, and it has since prevented $60 million in flood damages. And Oslo is currently on the list of projects because they have to upgrade their levees. One thing that happens in the Red River that makes some of these projects real expensive is there's very poor soils. So you really have to move the levees back further away from the river's edge so you have better stability.
To that third point of the top box,
yes.
We call it 100-year flood, but they're not really 100-year floods. Isn't that correct?
Well, the 100-year flood is a 1% chance of occurrence, and so it's just based on probability. And it can occur on any, you know, any day. Each day starts a new year as far as probability. And many of the floods that we've had recently are well above the 100-year or that 1% chance occurrence. The Northeast flood that just occurred in Duluth was close to a 500-year event, so a 0.5% chance of occurrence on any given day. So there are lots of larger floods. And a 100-year rainfall in this state is about 6 inches in 24 hours, and we probably have one of those somewhere in the state every year. But if it happens in a rural area, not on top of a town, you probably don't hear much about it, or if it's over a relatively small area. But in the ones that happened in southeastern Minnesota, you had a large rainfall that stalled out and dropped a lot of rain over, you know, a day and a half, and those had, in some areas, it was 14 inches of rain, I believe, is the one that happened in the southeast. At 21, Representative David said in some areas. And so they had events that are going to occur that are much larger than the typical level of protection that's been discussed. The 100-year is kind of a misnomer. I mean, the federal government's used that. The flood insurance program started in 1969, and that's been the you know, kind of the threshold used. And to provide protection for the 500-year or bigger events would be you know, extremely expensive. So there is a balancing act, too, on where how much do you put in to protect against a real rare event. The moving on, the in Moorhead, since 2009, the mitigation efforts that we've done there and the dollars we've spent have resulted in the city needing far fewer sandbags to provide the same level of protection. And they estimate just in that they've saved $6.5 million in having to do fewer sandbags to protect their city. Because they end up cost, from what the city says, it's probably about $3 per bag to buy it, fill it, store it, place it, remove it. You know, from birth to death of a sandbag is about that. The flood hazard mitigation program started in 1987. It's set in statutes 103F-161. And we have hundreds of projects that are completed or underway across the state. We look at the permanent removal of floodplain structures from the floodplain first. Basically, we like to get the lowest out, the most at risk, are done first. Then we look at permanent protection that where buyouts aren't possible, and that's levees, flood walls, pumping stations, floodproofing. And we also have funded a number of impoundments which helped to reduce the peak discharges, and they would provide a factor of safety above the 100-year protection or whatever level of protection you're providing. There is a cost share in the statutes. The statutory cost share is 50-50. And there have been, there's a number of federal projects that we've completed in the state. East Grand Forks, and we're in the process of Roseau and Breckenridge are almost done, Warren. And there, the federal government has paid, started out at 75%, now it's 65%. And then we would split the non-federal share 50-50. But beyond that, there's been rider language in most of the recent bonding bills that have limited the local share for municipalities to a cost that's not greater than 2% of the median household times the number of households. And one of the reasons that came about was East Grand Forks, the non-federal share of that project was going to be about $60 million, and that city couldn't afford $30 million for a flood mitigation project, and it probably never would have been built. And so that evolved during that time after the 1997 flood, and it has existed pretty much in all of the funding bills since then.
And do you have any observations about that third point? It was for that one purpose. Do you get a sense that continues to be relevant to
the? Yes, Madam Chair. The one of the arguments at that time was that the Corps of Engineers estimated the ongoing operation and maintenance for that federal project at East Grand Forks to be a little over $1 million a year, and that is a local responsibility that is ongoing. So part of that was looked at as the as an ongoing local share that they would have to undertake. So, and the number was, just evolved through legislative discussions. I would think without the 2% funding, a lot of these projects probably would not be built. I think there's some that are. The city of Moorhead, the city of Austin is basically 50-50. I think they've also passed a sales tax that helps them fund their project. And that number works out to be about 50-50 anyway, with looking at what their 2% obligation would have been. Moorhead's 2% obligation changed from, because we readjust these when the new census data comes out. So from the 2000 census, Moorhead's number was a little over 8 million. The 2010 census had jumped up to 12 million. And so in our next grant, we adjusted that to the current data. And they're actually going to have, once this is fully funded and completed, Moorhead will have about $18 million in it. So they're paying more than just that minimum. But on the smaller communities, I think without this funding, that they would not, they would probably not continue with the projects. This graph shows the funding history for the flood hazard mitigation program. And you can see after 1997 that the funding went up significantly. And you can also see then when we've had other major events, the numbers have significantly risen. And this does include the disaster funding also. This map just shows the red on here are completed projects, the blue are projects that are in process. Some communities have had multiple projects, so it might look like they're, you can see this by the number of dots, or some that are finished and some aren't when they've had multiple projects. And there's a distribution pretty much across the state. There hasn't been a lot of things up in the Northeast, but other than the last big flood in last fall in Duluth. And there we aren't going to see a lot of mitigation projects. We will see the acquisition and removal of homes that were in the floodplain that were substantially damaged, but we aren't going to see the typical kinds of levies because they haven't been there haven't been a lot of repetitive losses. That's something that's tracked by FEMA and the state. And when we started this program, that's what we were looking at, is to address the repetitive loss communities first. And the big repetitive loss communities at that time were East Grand Forks, Warren, Breckenridge, and Roseau. And three of those four projects are essentially done, and Roseau's got some funding yet to go. But they're well in the way on Roseau. Just some more quick pictures. Like I have said, removing people and property from the floodplain is one of our highest priorities. And this is a picture in Montevideo, where over 128 homes have been removed from the floodplain since 1997. And this is the Smith Edition in Montevideo. This is a city of Oslo in 1997. So you can see it was protected by this levee, and otherwise it would have been totally inundated. And their project now is to fortify essentially the levees. You can see the river that snakes through the middle of this picture. And right now they can't they have to raise the levee as the flood is occurring because the soils are so bad. So what the project now is to move the levees further back from the river and have them at a permanent height. So it'll be a much better project that won't take much action when a flood occurs. This is a picture of a water impoundment. This is actually the Agassiz Valley project. So you can see this is a large, this is just a little bit southwest of the city of Warren. So the purpose of these is to impound the water and control its discharge so you can reduce damages downstream. And for conclusion, the you know, we did a recent survey of our grantees, current and former grantees, and a couple of years ago the legislative auditor did a report on flood hazard mitigation and disaster funding, and did suggest that we check and see how we're doing. And the results of the, and we're in the process of finalizing that report. But the results that we got back, we had about 70% response, I believe it was. The the 91% of those responded were extremely or very, they thought the program was extremely or very successful, and I guess I would agree with that.
Since did it vary regionally?
Excuse me?
Did that satisfaction vary regionally?
Madam Chair, no, this wasn't an anonymous survey, so I don't think that we could determine that. So it was pretty consistent in the responses, and I think, you know, we saw some responses. We probably figured we might know who they might have been, but generally everybody was understood the program and thought it went very well. Since 1987, we've made significant progress in reducing the flood risk. And, you know, in the 2009 flood, which was on the Red River at East Grand Forks, was close to a flood of record. And, you know, they had no problems. We were up there standing on the top of the levee, and the water was close to the toe of the levee. And they had their invisible flood wall in place. But it was essentially a non-event. You aren't hearing about those communities that we always used to hear about. And the potential for future flood damage and disaster spending has been significantly reduced. It won't totally go away because you can always have a bigger flood. And you know, based on our current estimates, there are still $100 million in unmet, unfunded flood mitigation needs. And the graphic here is to show that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I think we are making significant progress in this program. And now I will switch to this colored chart. And if people have questions, they can contact me or Pat Lynch, as I introduced as the program manager for this. And if you look at this this other handout, that's the colored list, the green projects are the projects that are completed. So you can see that we have, and this is really in the funding of just the last couple of years. We don't show the funding from 1987 on. And initially, this program did have general fund that we used to do feasibility studies. But recently, there's been no general fund. It's all been bonding appropriations. So there isn't a feasibility study piece of this anymore. That would have to be done with local dollars. And then we would fund the engineering design and construction. So what this chart shows on the left is the project names, the total project cost that's been estimated, the project description, is it a levee, a diversion, a flood wall. And then the last, or the next column says committed and not yet encumbered. With the 2011 and 2012 funding, we had, there was $80 million, $50 million and $30 million appropriations. And we've committed, we've spent most of that, and we've committed this other about $6 million you see in yellow on the bottom of funding. And that would leave, out of that $80 million, it would be about $2 million that's unspent.
Griffin Ward has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Loxamo, many times when we see a list, we see a prioritized list. I know, you know, this is in alphabetical order. Is there a priority? Do you have a priority of the unfinished projects? And how do you come to that conclusion of the priority?
And Representative Ward, by the way, you should have in your packet that one, but it's color-coded. Do we have another? We have one for you.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, we are developing a priority list. Yes, we do that. This is just showing an alphabetical list of all of the projects that we're aware of, all of the ones that have made application. Some of these are not ready to construct in 2013. Some of them are ongoing and should be constructed, allow construction to continue. The ones that are probably most ready would be Ada, Oslo, and Moorhead are probably the three that are the most ready. And North Ottawa Impoundment is an ongoing project that needs a little bit more funding to finish. And a lot of the rest of these are in various states. But we are putting together a priority list based on some assumptions of funding levels. One of the reasons we haven't done that yet is I don't have any direction from the administration on what a request might be. But we will be preparing a priority list that would show where we think the greatest risk is and who's really ready to spend. As our experience has shown that often what is presented here by others, they think they can spend the money a lot quicker and they're a lot more ready than they really are because there's a land problem or there's something and some of these drag on. The funding in recent years has been structured so the priority setting has been left to the agency, so we're able to fund projects on an ongoing basis and not give them $30 million up front and it takes them 5 years to spend it. We fund it in phases that are freestanding, that are compliant with bonding requirements, so you have something that's of benefit when the project is completed. But we do look at funding projects in phases and doing this where the money can be spent. And that's why out of the $80 million that we got in the last 2 years, we are only going to have a couple million dollars left for contingencies.
And members, then, you know that we do always like to make sure that once we have given approval for bonding projects that the money is spent immediately. And we've always found if we listen to Mr. Loxamo's advice as opposed to some of the requests from local governments, we probably get a better fix on what they're actually ready for that year, and it's been helpful to get that kind of feedback. Representative Spudzinski. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Ward, were you finished?
Thank you.
Representative Spudzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of this $100 million, what would you estimate the funds that would be asked for? Could be potentially spent within, you know, the next 2 years to 4 years? We talked a little bit about kind of that ready to go, even though, you know, they think they're ready, but maybe, you know, is that kind of the conversation here, the difference, then what percentage of that those funds would be ready to roll?
Mr. Block as well.
Madam Chair, Representative, the, you know, we haven't finished all of our analysis and all of our contacts with communities. I would say that are really, it's probably in the $25-30 million right away. In
over a 2 year period?
In a 2 year period, easily, yeah, $20-40 million. And beyond that, in the next 2 years, some of these I think need some development. If they had development money, they may be ready to go. So you'd probably have another $25 or $30 million, somewhere in that ballpark. And so the last column on this that I think people have already looked at is the remaining state dollars needed, and those numbers are with the assumption that the 2% median household language would continue.
And speaking of that, so for example, since that is income, let me see, what was the formula again? For 2% of median household income. So for example, Moorhead and Oakport Township are right next to one another, but I'm guessing that Oakport Township median income would be higher than Moorhead, so Oakport Township has paid more of a local share, would you think?
Madam Chair, generally, I think there, and I have a list that we could hand out that shows the calculations for the 2% of the median household income, if you would like that for the committee. They have fewer households, so I think it worked out to about $176,000. Okay. For Oakport Township.
Their share?
Yeah,
$741,000.
$741,000 for Oakport Township's 2% share.
Of total project of?
Their total project is now around $30 million. So, I mean, that project, that's probably the one of the highest per capita costs of a project. Most of them are less per capita.
And then, Mr. Loxmo, I would think it would be helpful. Some members know, but perhaps not all. There is this discussion by the Army Corps of Engineers and Minnesota and North Dakota about a potential very large project. Whether it will ever occur or not, we don't know, but I would think that perhaps members should at least know about that conversation. Just in case we say, now it's all done, and then that project comes along.
Madam Chair, I think as you noted before, it's very typically we don't hear we'll never hear another request for funding from a community, because you can always have another event or something else happen. So it's difficult to believe when they say we're all done. The $14.7 million that was the request from Moorhead finishes their interim works for doing what Moorhead needs to protect themselves, regardless of the federal project. There's also the federal Fargo-Moorhead diversion project, which is a large federal project to do an impoundment on the upstream side of Fargo to detain water, and then do a diversion around Fargo on the North Dakota side. It's about a $1.8 billion project now.
Billion, that was with a B.
That was with a B, yes. The cost share is yet to be determined. The federal determination of the benefit costs showed the benefits that accrue on the Minnesota side of the river are about 5% of that total, and 95% of the benefits accrue on the North Dakota side of the river. And what we've maintained as these discussions have gone along all the time is that any costs for Minnesota should be commensurate with the benefits that Minnesota receives. So of the non-federal share, and the non-federal share is going to be about $600-700 million, somewhere in that ballpark. And so we're saying at the most, ours should be the 5% of that $600 million. The North Dakota has been pressing for the state to contribute $200 million, somewhere in that ballpark. $100-200 million is what they've believed that Minnesota's share should be. None of these requests recently have dealt with that project. It still has to finish the federal EIS. There has to be a state of Minnesota EIS, because this withholding structure that they're building on the south side of Moorhead is a high-hazard dam, so that needs a state EIS. There has to be construction in Minnesota. We couldn't spend bonding money on a project that's out of state. If you look at the list that Ms. Dyson prepared, there was the $3.9 million for Browns Valley. That was general fund. That was general fund because that project was a diversion that was built in South Dakota, so it had to be general fund, not general obligation bonds. So a lot of this, there will be some construction in Minnesota if this project proceeds. Whether or not that would be enough to fully cover what is anticipated to be a Minnesota share. There is local opposition to this project from Wilkin County and the communities that are impacted on the upstream side of this project. So whether or not there's going to be, and Moorhead, quite frankly, is going to be very well protected when this, when their interim works get done.
Representative McNamer has a question.
Madam Chair, Mr. Loxmo, the diversion would infringe on landowners in Minnesota, and what I've heard is the Morehead area in Minnesota is fairly well secure. The diversion probably wouldn't be that beneficial to us, only harmful.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, the upstream impoundment to make the diversion work will require flowage easements from about 56,000 acres of land in North Dakota and Minnesota. So those people and communities are adversely impacted. This provides Morehead is going to be quite well protected by the interim works that we've funded. This project would provide an added factor of safety. The city of Winnipeg, for example, downstream on the Red River, has about 700-year protection if you use the number of year protection. And the argument by the local governments there has been we should have a 500-year or larger protection for this major metropolitan area. And that's mostly, that's coming from the North Dakota side, and Fargo certainly is their economic engine more than on the Minnesota side. But both communities would benefit from this. The question of how much they need it is kind of what level of protection should you be providing.
Did you have a follow-up?
Madam Chair, and Mr. Locksmall, it's not the communities I'm worried about. It's the farmland to the south of the communities that's in Wilkin County and Clay County that would be inundated or flooded by the diversion project. And that would affect a lot of Minnesota farmers. Is there a way we can prevent that from happening?
Mr. Lockesbone, that's probably the controversial part of it.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara.
McNamara.
Those farmers and that farmland will be adversely affected. Now, how often depends on the frequency of these events, but I think if you look at the precipitation patterns, the frequency of large events seems to be increasing, so it may impact them. There really is, you would have to change the project to not have the impoundment on the upstream side. And you could do a diversion, and you could probably do a smaller diversion. You could do other things that would provide some factor of safety. Whether or not that would still meet the federal government benefit cost is questionable. And I haven't seen a federal project constructed in Minnesota that has come in on time and under cost yet. So what this may ultimately cost is anybody's guess. And whether or not they could get all of the local participation to continue with this is, I think, still unknown.
Madam Chair, Mr. Locksmall, could the impoundment prevent flooding enough so the diversion in the Fargo-Moorhead area wouldn't be needed?
Mr. Locksmall.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are other impoundments on the upstream side that have been constructed. North Ottawa provides that protection. Yep. There's a number of other ones that are proposed that are on this list that were handed out, Red Path and a number of others, that provide some of that storage and some benefit. Do they provide as much as the covering 56,000 acres with water? No, but over time they would provide additional protection to the communities.
Members, there was one year when our committee actually did a tour just of the Red River Valley and all of those issues like impoundment and others, because as you can see from all the history in your packet this morning, there has been a huge amount of state commitment, and to get a handle on this, I think, has been Representative Swinsinski, you've Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I got the second handout here, Mr. Lockesall, it says community number of households, MHI, et cetera. And so my question is on the number of households. Let's take, for example, Morehead has 14,304 number of households. Is that the number of households in that area that will be impacted, or is that just the total number of households in the area? Or can you define for me a little better of what that number of household figure means?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that is the number of households in the community. Mm-hmm. So it's not just in the floodplain or the ones that are benefited. It's the total number of households. This data we take from the it's the U.S. Census data. It's taken from you know, other state agencies. It's not our data. We're just taking their numbers and doing the math.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further to your presentation?
Madam Chair, not at this time. As I indicated, we will be preparing some priority list on the projects that are ready to go, and those numbers were pretty, you know, off the top of my head. So I think they may change, and but we'll be providing that to you as soon as we can.
Well, and for the members who just arrived, Minsky had a breakfast, I think, this morning that some have been to, but there's there are just lots of reports in your packet, and you can quickly, I think, just look at some of those totals to get a sense of the presentation.
And Minsky had some really great projects they were proposing, so I'm sure they'll be here to show us all.
And they probably had a great breakfast as well, St. Paul College being what it is.
I did my best.
Thank you, Mr. Lacasmo.
Welcome.
There are no further questions, and we will then invite Mr. Jaski, John Jaski. And are you joined at the table with Tim Kohler? And we've put these together because we believe they do have a connection, and I'm sure we'll hear something about the use of these dollars for, among other things, flood prevention, habitat creation, wildlife protection, all of those good side effects. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Jaski, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. And with me is Tim Kohler, our WMS Minnesota Easement Section Administrator. As you were saying, you know, Mr. Lagosmo's presentation focused on specifically the flood damage reduction projects. And as he indicated, you know, one of the ways that we attempt to minimize flood damages downstream is to store water upstream, and certainly one of the places that we do that is areas where we have basins that have been drained that can be restored, and this program is one of the ways it accomplishes that flood benefit is by doing that very thing, is holding water on the land before it's released downstream. And so in many, many places, if we do that, we can achieve some flood reduction benefits, and we've seen that in areas not only in Red River Valley, but also in South Central Minnesota. Austin and Albert Lea areas have had a significant effort to do that. We have seen Southwestern Minnesota. There is an organization called the Area 2 Flood Control Organization, which does, as a joint powers of counties, build these smaller scale retention and projects to hold water back, you know, sometimes along a road area where they can raise a culvert and things like that. So lots of small storage areas are a key part of flood damage reduction as well, including, you know, of course, the structural things like levees and diversions and large impoundments. What we're going to do is give you a brief overview of the Reinvest in Minnesota program. I'll do a little bit of introduction, and Mr. Kohler will talk about the program and how it works. As you indicated, it has multiple benefits. Flooding is just one of those. Wildlife habitat, water quality, even some things that go beyond that in terms of economic use for haying and grazing in certain cases. But this program has been around since 1986, 26 years now, having been very successful, you know, in both applying state funds to the land, but also leveraging federal dollars, particularly through the U.S. Federal Farm Bill. And also, actually, more recently, with the Department of Defense, with some projects up around the Camp Ripley area of central Minnesota. So we won't go into all those details, but we'll give you a quick overview, and then we'll have time for any questions that you may have. So just a quick overview of the program itself. We will show you the history of the funding, at least the most recent funding in the past 10 years or so. We'll talk about the priorities and the focus of the program, and then talk about some of the benefits and examples of the easements that the major part of the funding goes for, a permanent conservation easement on these private lands areas. Our agency, just very briefly, Madam Chair, members, is that we work with private land. These projects that we do are on private land, which of course is you know, the vast majority of the state. We work with willing landowners to do lots of conservation and clean water endeavors. Our Reinvest in Minnesota program is a key part of that, where we use easements to secure the land rights and then restore the lands and put the wetland back or establish a riparian buffer, retire the land that's marginal. Our agency is a small agency. We have a staff of about 80 or so individuals, and we use our local governments as the delivery mechanism. And in the case of the RIM program, we use the Soil and Water Conservation District's set of offices in each and every county in the state to be the local agent to work with those local individual landowners, because people, when they decide to do something on their land, really want to have a local and trusted expert that they can go to. They are, you know, not too interested in coming to St. Paul to work out these details. They want someone who can be trusted locally to help them figure out their options, design the project, and then be there if problems arise. And we use those local offices to do our inspections to make sure that we have the asset that's been secured is protected and maintained. You know, by and large, these projects do not require, you know, O&M, because you're restoring nature back to the way it was. And if you do pick the right spot and you do a good design, then it's supposed to be there until, I guess, the next glacier comes along and takes it out. But until then, it's going to function as nature put it there. So,
one of the places that we don't have to worry about operating dollars once we build something.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's largely true. You know, the one obligation that does continue is to make sure that the state asset is inspected, to make sure that there isn't some inadvertent or, you know, improper use of that land, which would be a violation issue. But we've had very, very, very few of those. I think that we have nearly 6,000 easements now, and so we've had, you know, but a couple each year we have a question about, and we remedy that with, you know, typically an inadvertent use of the land is put back, and it's on the landowner's dime, but they have to fix that. So the state doesn't have an obligation that continues other than just making sure that asset is there. So let Mr. Kohler talk about how the program works in terms of the way the system we've built gets the results on the ground.
Thank you, John, and Madam Chair and committee members. Most of you have a general sense for how we work with the RIM Reserve program here in Minnesota. But this chart, a little bit busy, but it kind of shows the three-faceted part of RIM as we use it. Again, as John mentioned, and will continue to emphasize the fact of a local delivery system, our local soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and others. So we provide resources to them in the left side of this this diagram to help us implement the program. Obviously, one of the major parts of the program and funding that might be secured is payments to landowners. As John mentioned, this is a privately held land that we secure an easement from voluntary landowners. So there's payments made to them, as well as payments to restore the land. And then the economic part of it in the right-hand side there. These dollars are generally cycled through many times through the business cycle with people buying seed, people building structures, and, you know, et cetera. So so there's a multiplier effect tied to that. So.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. You talk about the economic part of this. What percentage, you know, 2 cents out of every dollar, 50 cents out of every dollar goes to the economic development of the area that you put these in?
Mr. Kohler, is it Kohler or Caleb?
It's Kohler, Madam Chair.
Mr. Yep. Kohler.
In our handout, and maybe in this document, there's a, and sorry that we have it in a couple different places, but we have a piece in there that talks about creating and sustaining jobs. And my previous employer, before I retired here a few months ago and spent 3 days retired and then came to work for the state, we did a study back in 2010 with some national economics people and studied what was happening here in Minnesota. And so some of the things that they found, and granted it's 2010, but the way the economy's gone and inflation and et cetera, the numbers are still very valid. So you can see that for instance, if there was a $30 million level of funding, it's projected, the numbers that are there are projected economic impact. We generally, if we utilize federal leveraging, can get 1.6 or so dollars for every state dollar that we use. We create hundreds of jobs with these funds, as well as the economic activity. So I was a little unclear of the 2% number that you were asking about, but the economic impact is definitely multiplied many times over and kind of substantiated for us.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to clarify, what's your 2%? I was just using as an example. So out of every dollar that's spent in CRP or RIM, you know, how much goes to the economic development? And you can follow up with me later. I don't want to take up the time here.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we can get you a copy of this analysis that was done by economists, and they'll have those details, I'm sure, in that report. I know they do, but I can't remember them, neither can Mr. Kolder.
Yeah.
We'll get that at least to Representative Mahoney. I don't know if there are others who want to just let us know. Mr.
Kohler? So, Madam Chair, we'd like to then just briefly mention on the next page of the handout some past history and some of the things that we've been utilizing funding through the Capital Investment Committee's for with RIM. You can see from this chart there's some major kind of blips on here. We've received some regular bonding funds over the years, as well as emergency bonding. The first number that I might just to kind of get to some of the deals, 2001, if many of you remember, was the first year of the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, or CREP, down in Minnesota Valley. So you see a large $72 million appropriation there that was primarily CREP 1. We've had in 2006 a pretty hefty bonding allocation that was tied to a joint project with the USDA with the Wetlands Reserve Program. In the last two appropriations, 12 and 13, we've been working to try to secure CRP lands, as well as other high priority projects that deal with flooding and deal with wildlife habitat. On the emergency bonding side, you see probably the one that jumps out the most there is in fiscal year 11, when we had the flooding in the 29 southern counties of the state. We were appropriated $10 million and have been working with landowners to secure lands in floodplains and flood-prone areas. The last number there, that $1.5 million, is from this past summer of 2012 floods up in the Duluth area, as well as southern Minnesota. So we've utilized quite a bit of bonding funding, and money isn't the only thing, obviously, that might spark some interest. But we've gone ahead and protected about 115,000 acres with the bonding funding, and again with multiple benefits that has received and have provided. So,
Representative Detmer has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. How closely do you work with, like, some of the watershed districts in the area? I know I have Rice Creek Watershed District that runs through my area. How closely do you work with these districts?
Mr. Kohler. So,
Madam Chair and Representative, we work with local governments on a daily basis and project-related, as well as overall perspective. So the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and the Watershed Districts are our two primary partners with the RIM program. John's going to mention a few, Mr. Jassy is going to mention a few examples later that will show some specific examples where we've done some stuff with some watershed districts. They generally will formulate a lot of the project and project ideas, and that's another part of our joint partnership. Oftentimes, with the engineering assistance that they provide and that they have available to them, they'll do some of the heavy lifting on the engineering side. We'll come along and help them with the land rights part of easements, as well as, you know, possibly some of the costs for insulation. So we have had a pretty decent history working with the watershed districts in regards to this. So,
yeah. Madam Chair, now Bowser is appointed by governor, right? Am I correct on that?
Mr. Kohler.
The Bowser, Madam Chair, Representative the Bowser Chair, yeah, Brian Knapstad is a governor appointee, yep.
Okay. And then the local watershed, Madam Chair, the local watershed districts, then they are appointed by the counties, am I correct there?
Mr. Kohler.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, yes, the watershed districts are appointed by the county commissioners.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have a question sometimes with constituents. They attend meetings and so forth, and we have no elected officials on any of these boards. Where does local people go to, you know, in terms of if they have a problem with what's going on, they come to us. And sometimes that gets to be a problem where, you know, a lot of times the watershed district, they can levy taxes, they can, you know, so forth. And the big complaint there that I have is that we have, you know, levying taxes without representation. And so that tends to be a problem sometimes. I don't know if anybody else have run into that, but just wanted to make that comment.
Representative Ward?
So to thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Detmer, let me just add this in. Soil and Water Conservation Districts are elected. Watershed districts are appointed by the County Commissioners, as you said. They vary in number of size within the respective county, but the Soil and Water Conservation District people are elected, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, that is absolutely correct. And in both of them are established by a petition from the citizens or the county board in the case of watershed districts. So there is a local impetus to establish both of those organizations.
Okay, thank you. And I just wanted to clear that up in my mind as well. Thank you for that. And let me just ask one more question, Madam Chair, if I might, with in regards to RIM and conservation and Bowser and soil water and all of it. I know that, I think as we can do conservation in the state of Minnesota, conservation area, projects in the state of Minnesota, either through RIM or whatever, I think it's extremely important. I was very fortunate with the help of Representative Lilly and others in a committee last year. This was in the Legacy Committee, to have a wonderful piece of property, 2,000 acres, 2 miles of water frontage, conserved. For the future generations of the citizens in my district, tell me if you might please, so some conservation easements and working with private landowners come from legacy funds, but this is using bonding funds. And I had to step out for a minute, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, but maybe you already addressed this. If you did, I'm sorry for repeating this question.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, no, the question wasn't asked previously, at least not here. And so your question, I guess, is, you know, are there legacy funds that are used to accomplish the goals of the legacy amendment, clean water or habitat, using the RIM program? And the answer is yes. We also use the program, as I mentioned before, to leverage federal funding under that Central Minnesota Camp Ripley, called ACUB area. So with the program, it's a statutory program, Minnesota Statute 103F.515, and it can be used to accomplish multiple goals with multiple funding sources. And so that is what we've been doing. We can provide you a more detailed summary of all of those pieces if you'd like that at some point, but we were focused on the bonding appropriations in this committee.
And Madam Chair, just the final, I think. So in your opinion, gentlemen, you know, working with private landowners, for easement conservation parcels and things as such, has this been a pretty successful and good use of public dollars?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, you know, we certainly believe so. I mean, it's a case where you build something and it's there forever. We get multiple benefits out of it, of flood control, water quality, you know, habitat, and some other things. So we believe it is very cost-effective, and it's a durable, basically a forever investment that will, you know, hopefully, you know, have many people appreciate it over time. And we have, you know, thousands of easements in many places around the state. It is focused on marginal land, so we're taking land out of production, or that's the marginal land that wouldn't be as useful for something else, and using it for what nature had originally intended it.
Thank you.
And, you know, we're just checking our memory, because we were looking at those years 8, 9, 10 when we thought we did quite a bit more. And in fiscal year 08, we have $25 million. So what happened to that amount? Why doesn't that show up?
Madam Chair, I don't know. We'll have to reconcile that. If we had it may have been that we looked at the wrong year. I'll have to double check on that, but we'll make sure that this information is correct. We've got appropriations that come in different pieces of legislation over the years, and we'll make sure it's correct and get that to you. We'll talk to your staff about it.
Do that too. And members, I will remember the year 2010 because that's when we also had $25 million, and that was we were scheduled to match a significant amount of federal money, and that was line item vetoed. So that was a painful loss.
Madam Chair and representatives, John, it was omitted from this because we just the $25 million in 2008 funding, because we just hit our final obligation encumbrance period on that money on 12/31. So there is a $25 million omission on this chart. So so we'll correct that and make sure that gets updated to you.
Please continue.
So we wanted to maybe hit a little bit on what bonding money could be used for if it was appropriated this year, and some of the major challenges that we're facing, and as Representative Ward mentioned, you know, we receive funding from other sources that are a little bit more directed to a specific groundwater issue or to a specific, you know, wildlife issue or whatever, and in addition to that, we have some kind of overarching things that as an agency and with our partners and others that we've been kind of looking at. And one is the Conservation Reserve Program. The Conservation Reserve Program is a USDA Farm Service Agency program that is a short-term rental program. As most of you know, people receive a rental payment, you know, for a 10-year period. And as the chart shows in that windblown picture to the right of that windblown picture, in the five-year period starting in 12, Minnesota is set to lose about a little more than 800,000 acres of CRP land. That land right now is primarily in native vegetation and other vegetation, and is providing a multitude of benefits. Once it's lost, once it's plowed up and planted to corn, or once its houses are put on it, or whatever the other use is, we obviously have a real challenge going backwards to try to provide those environmental benefits again. And one of the things that happened, and so I'm not just estimating what may happen. We have some real data that just happened from the 2012 year. You can see that we were going to lose almost 300,000 acres of expiring CRP land. And sure enough, about half of that land was not re-enrolled. And so we lost about 144,000 acres and those environmental benefits that were tied to those acres. So if things were to happen with continued crop prices and land prices and the rest, and we lost roughly a 50% level of CRP or more, you know, we're looking at losing something like 400,000 acres of CRP over the next number of years. So one of the priorities for our agency and our board and many partners is to try to deal with that CRP land before it expires. Give landowners another option. Many of these landowners, you know, if given an easement option, will go ahead and leave it in a protected state. And so it's a big issue, and you know, we need to put it high on our radar. Not only though for kind of the numbers and the environmental part of it too, but also from the leveraging perspective. We're allowed to continue to, we put an easement on top of that land, even though there's a rental contract on it for another year or two or whatever it might be. And so the landowner is able to continue to get their CRP payments for a year or two, and then it's permanently protected forever with our permanent rim easement. So we are able to leverage a little bit of funding there, make it a little bit more attractive, maintain those environmental benefits again. I don't want to emphasize enough, but once it's plowed up, it's going to take a lot to try to talk someone back into applying and getting it put in back into conservation, and then reinstalling the conservation, replanting the trees, replanting the grass, whatever. It's a much better option to take it as it's already been protected. So,
and I think this slide is so clear, multiple benefits, wildlife, water quality, flood mitigation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Another big priority for us, and you've heard talk of this probably from Commissioner Landwehr and John Jasky and others, is implementing the Minnesota Prairie Plan. This aggressive 25-year plan is trying to protect virgin prairie, but also trying to protect grasslands in the agricultural landscape. And as a part of that, there's a 5-year plan. We're taking it in chunks, basically. And in that 5-year plan, Bowser's been asked to try to provide 10,000 to 20,000 acres a year in easements in grassland habitats. Now, again, this grassland might be in CRP, so it kind of takes care of that CRP issue also, but it also might not be in CRP. It might be land that that is currently being grazed or currently being used for other reasons. We have, and this gets back to a question I know that you asked Mr. Lacasmole. We're really far along on the prairie plan concepts and implementation, and this map, and it's a little bit larger size on the handout, so you may not need a magnifying glass to see some of these holes, and we can get you a full size of this stuff. We've already identified 11 project areas that are priorities for a number of reasons, and within them, we have some core areas that we're focusing in. We've already gotten to the point working with the Nature Conservancy and DNR, Pheasants Forever, and others, where we've already identified parcels in each of these areas that are high priority for us to retain grassland. So we actually have landowner names. We have local conservation districts and local teams getting ready to kind of ramp up and talk to these landowners and give them options in addition to the other options that they have available to them. So, again, it's always a landowner choice. It's always voluntary conservation. If somebody wants to grow corn or if somebody doesn't want an easement on it, that's their choice. But we've already gotten into a pretty focused prioritization potential with implementing the Minnesota Prairie Plan. So we're really in a focused way. And I just would hit the last item then real quick and then turn it over to Mr. Jaski for some examples too. As John said, another large use of prior bonding funds has been flood mitigation. And it's not just flood mitigation. Flood mitigation with very many other multiple benefits. We generally work with, as I mentioned, local soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, private landowners, and others. And we try to, attain these this flood mitigation with multiple benefits. So, obviously, you said you toured the Red River, Madam Chair, and I think we were together on a site that was more of a bonding wildlife site just north of Detroit Lakes. And I know you saw North Ottawa and a few other sites. So there's a ton of wildlife benefits and other benefits, water quality benefits. So when we talk flood mitigation and easements, it's not just a kind of primary purpose piece of it. But this picture shows some new technology that we've been working on. And the Natural Resource Conservation Service and a number of other partners have done an engineering watershed tool model where, and again, I apologize for the smallness of this, and we can show you some of this on a larger scale at some point too. But we're able to identify with the use of the LIDAR technology, the computer animated ability to show topography changes, we can identify catchment areas for any area in the state right now that's covered with the LIDAR. So we're able to utilize this data, go talk to local conservation districts and local staff, go talk to landowners, and provide, as the example shows there, small catchment areas that, again, can provide flood mitigation benefits as well as many multiple benefits. I think most would agree that any type of flood mitigation strategy is going to take a toolbox full of different different tricks. We may have to, not tricks, but different options. We may have large projects like in North Ottawa. We may have small landowner projects where we may be holding water back on a 5-acre wetland like in that picture. We may have road authorities doing different things, but it's going to take all sorts of different strategies in order to meet flood mitigation goals. So the Rim Reserve, we can do these small catchment areas and provide a multitude of benefits, including flood mitigation. So this is another one where we're kind of itching at the trigger and ready to go with going out and working on flood mitigation areas, small catchments, working with watershed districts who have already identified some key sub-watersheds. So.
Yeah, Madam Mr. Chair, members, the targeting is, indicative in this photo here where we can, use the computer data that we've had now with LIDAR and other models to show what's possible. Now, of course, the reality is that when you get to the actual sites and talk with the landowners and understand where property lines are and where, you know, other infrastructure issues have to be addressed. We know many of these have to be either, you know, not accomplished, or we move on to the ones that can be accomplished. But there's plenty of opportunity. It's just a matter of finding the best places to put these, and using, you know, a cost-benefit approach with these models has been very much something that our local watershed districts in Red River Valley and Solon Water Districts have been using in the last few years. A couple of examples of projects, you know, they're all different, and we've got, you know, thousands of them, but here's an example of one maybe we have shown you before, where a channelized stream is being remeandered to slow the water down, which does provide both water quality and habitat and flood reduction, flood damage reduction benefits. There will be an easement that will be secured over this area, and this one could even be enhanced potentially by establishing a small berm, if you were to think about it, you know, on the perimeter of this meandered stream. In fact, that's a lot of times what's going to be necessary, because you have to both provide more area to store and allow the water to move where it once did upstream, but we also have to protect this this cropland from being, you know, flooded unpredictably as well. And so the watershed districts have been working on some small berms to provide a, you know, maybe a 20-year flood event protection for those farmlands, whereas we provide a much higher threshold of protection for the communities downstream. And there's been a lot of work done. River Basin Commission worked with a number of organizations to prepare a, you know, a long-term flood strategy, and the goal of that was to reduce the main stage flood elevations on the Red River by 20%, and, you know, a lot of that would be accomplished by storage upstream. Now, you can't achieve enough of that in a lot of dispersed places to not do other things too. As Mr. Lacosmo said, we have to flood-proof our communities downstream. We have to be able to, even in some cases, consider diversions, you know, given the scale of the risk that's there. But storing water upstream can both provide additional protection downstream, but also provide multiple benefits in those areas where these projects are accomplished. This is an example of a more urban area. This is in Lake Waconia in Carver County. And this is a project where you can see the red line is actually, we were able to secure a little bit more land than was originally proposed, but here we've got a wetland that's going to be restored really just upstream of Lake Waconia, and this is an area where it's currently being, it's a sod farm, and the landowner has been finally willing to enroll in the program. These ditches will be blocked, the pumps will be turned off, the grasses will be restored. And this will be a nice, you know, not only an asset to the community visually, but obviously a huge water quality benefit to Lake Waconia, and it will provide the habitat, you know, to the species that are interested in the wetland, and probably the fish in the lake will benefit as well. Now, this one's a little bit unique because we'd like to get more upland buffer around it, but given the land values in this location and the, you know, willing to work with landowners who are interested in offering up an easement for their property, we've got what we've got here, but it's still a very effective project. And you can see the chart on the right shows a study that was done by the U.S. Geological Survey that shows, they looked at three, we've got, you know, more than this one graph, certainly if you want to see it, but there are three watersheds they looked at in southwestern Minnesota, and the Minnesota River watershed, and they looked at one that the two watersheds on the left are ones that did not have a lot of wetland restoration and buffers in them, and the one on the right had a good bit of that in the last 8 or 10 years, and there were immediate, well, within 8 or 10 years anyway, indications that the water quality, and as measured by the biology in the stream, the macroinvertebrates in the small fish had dramatically improved. So, you know, the water quality benefits certainly are recognizable and documented.
Representative Detmer has a question.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, this hits home with the watershed districts. You know, we have a lot of ditches around the state, you know, not just in the seven-county metro area that have been there for years. I mean, we're talking years. And a lot of our landowners or farmers are having problems with, you know, flooding of some of their cropland just because the ditches haven't been maintained. And could you just kind of touch on that? You know, sometimes all they want to do is just clean the ditch out to where it was originally, mm-hmm. and to allow the water to flow. But urbanization, you know, a lot of building up of the area, they become more strained with runoff. How big of a problem do we have? It's a pretty expensive problem too for the taxpayers.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, you're describing a challenging part of our state where we've got a history of what was once rural land, farmland, along with a lot of either current or previously wet land, right? And these drainage systems were built, you know, more than 100 years ago for a purpose that worked very well at the time. And as the land use changed, you know, as the farming became less of an issue and, you know, urbanization and development of some sort became more of an issue, there was kind of a transition period there where there wasn't really a lot of attention paid to these systems and maintenance of those, because you do need good drainage for both urban and rural development and infrastructure. And certainly that Rice Creek watershed area has been very challenging. So there are laws that prescribe what you can and can't do, and if you can do it, you know, how you do it. The Reinvest Minnesota program is about working with some of those challenging locations, but offering a conservation easement to put the wetland back the way it was, if that can be managed, you know, recognizing that private property rights have to always be accommodated. In some cases, we've actually had to build, and you don't see it in these examples, small earthen berms to hold the water from getting onto a neighboring property, because if you're going to put the water back and that neighbor was counting on it, you know, not being there, we've got to be able to make sure that the wetland that's going to be restored on property A won't impinge on property B. So that is a key part of our engineering team that does the assessments on these projects. And obviously, you know, not every situation can be remedied that nicely, but we appreciate the issues that you're facing in your district, because they're a challenging landscape, flat, wet, and changing use of the land.
Okay, I think you're just about finished.
Yes, I am, Madam Chair. And just as a summary here, you know, we do we use the science to figure out where the most important projects are. You know, we don't, you know, take somebody's land without them willing to offer it, but we go to the places where they're going to get the most benefit through the targeting tools that we talked about for flooding, for habitat, and for water quality. We can narrow down the most critical places. And as Mr. Kohler said, you know, one of our priorities right now is that we've got a major, you know, really disinvestment in the federal conservation program, the CRP program, and one of the best investments for the state to make is to be able to hang on to that conservation. It's there, that's on a temporary scale, and we're not going to be able to hang on to even most of it. It's going to be a very small fraction of it, frankly. If you're looking at 150,000 acres a year, if we can hang on to 10% of that in the most critical places, that's the kind of goals that we're trying to reach here. You know, some of that land does need to go back into production because it was enrolled as a kind of a temporary hiatus from that. But the most critical areas along our rivers and lakes, our most important wetlands that we can restore, those are the things that we're looking to do with the program in the years ahead. So with that, Madam Chair, I will stop, and you can take any questions.
Members, it's amazing when you think about the content they've given us today. They're just two small lines on the bonding bill, flood mitigation and RIM, mm-hmm. and yet the vast amount of history and potential that we've heard about today is quite mm-hmm. impressive in those two line items. So it was a good presentation of facts. Any concluding comments for the two of you? And any further questions from committee members? Thank you very much. Members, the next two meetings we are not meeting on Thursday, February 14th, or Tuesday, February 19th, and then the next meeting, February 21st, will be housing, and that's both public housing and the nonprofit housing, both from MHFA. And then a very big project last year we did the pre-design and design for, and that's the very big project last year we did the pre-design and design for, and that's the Security Hospital in St. Peter. Some of you have toured that, and a fairly significant ask. We'll be spending some time on that on Thursday, February 21st. Representative McNamer, I think you had time to read the minutes of Tuesday, February 5th.
Madam Chair, I move to approve the minutes.
Any changes, additions, corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Those minutes are approved. And I think that concludes today's information. Meeting is adjourned.